BGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are going to talk about the plan for Canada to once again bring peace to the world.
I'm here as a member of the United Nations Peace Force. Now, both of you, go home.
This is not your problem, Canadian soldier.
Wait for that. The world is changing really fast, and I'm not sure where we fit in. Putin, Modi, and Xi Jinping got together last week. You probably saw the pictures. They were smiling and holding hands, just three bros being bros. Looks like we've lost Russia and India to deepest, darkest China, is what Trump posted in response. America has lost Russia, India, and China. America lost Canada, if you believe our prime minister. Remember what he said? That old relationship is over. It's the Carney quote. Where does this leave us? Who's our squad? Who is Canada broing down with? We were not invited to that hang with India, Russia, and China. We don't hang out at Mar-a-Lago anymore. So where? Here's a hint. This might be the table that we're sitting at in the cafeteria. French President Emmanuel Macron said last week that 26 of Ukraine's allies have formally committed to deploying troops to Ukraine by land, sea, or air. He didn't say who those 26 ally countries are, but it is a pretty safe bet that we are on that list. Just look at what Carney said when he was last in Ukraine just a few weeks back. Quote, we are working through with our allies and the coalition of the willing and with Ukraine the modalities of those security guarantees on land, in the air, and the sea, and I would not exclude the presence of troops. Macron said that he does not see these troops as a combat force. We're not going to go there and wage war against Russia. Not a combat force, but a, quote, reassurance force. You know, kind of like peacekeepers. Here's what Putin thought of that. He responded that any foreign troops deployed into this conflict will be regarded by Russia as legitimate targets. Is that the table we want to sit at? Is that the list that we want to be on? The legitimate targets list? Who is this squad that we're getting involved with? What is this team all about, this coalition of the willing? These are Western democratic nations that are united, but without America. We're a squad that is, I guess, clinging to the old world order, hoping against hope that our reassuring presence can stop things from just splitting apart at the seams. This is a beleaguered team. This is a team of countries that still say things like two-state solution and a ceasefire from Putin with a straight face. I guess that's our squad. I guess that's our list. If we don't join that list, we may end up on a different list. And that list goes a little something like this. Ukraine, Taiwan, Canada. The sitting duck list. The easy pickings list. Maybe we are already on it. I am sorry if this is a bummer. I don't mean to bum you out, but we need to speak plainly about things. This is a time for blunt words. We do not have time to play games. We don't have the luxury of comforting national fictions of Canada the good, of Canada the global peacekeepers in blue helmets once again. Do you remember all that?
Yes, hostages! We will execute them! That is what I said!
You may do what you want with me, but these poor young people are entirely innocent.
Shut up! I said, look! Get down, all of you! You cockroach!
Drop your weapon. Your men are disarmed and the place is surrounded. You will drop your weapon.
It was Canada that proposed the United Nations Peacekeeping Force in 1956. General Jacques Destraz of the Royal Fusiliers of Montreal would later become head of our armed forces.
Or maybe it was a national branding exercise. Whatever it is, it's done. We are a long way from all that. We are a long way from Lester B. Pearson and his Nobel Peace Prize. We're a long way from Lloyd Axworthy and his Ottawa Treaty against landmines around the world. Aren't we? Lloyd Axworthy doesn't think so. Here is what he wrote in the Globe and Mail recently. Canada has an opportunity to lead. A world shaken by war, climate disruption, and mass displacement needs peacekeepers more than ever. Rebuilding our peacekeeping capacity would help shape a new world order. I read that in the Globe and Mail, and look, respect to Lloyd Axworthy. Literally, a lot of people still have a lot of respect for Lloyd Axworthy, and deservedly so. This is a guy who spent a life in politics. He was in Parliament under Pierre Trudeau, under John Turner, under Jean Chrétien. He was Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs. He was president of the UN Security Council. He was in the game for decades. He held down the left flank of the Liberal Party for like 30 years, and you will not find any smut on his rep. But when I read this piece that he just wrote in the Globe and Mail, I got to tell you, I did not take it seriously as a plan for Canada's future. It felt more like an elder statesman clinging to the past, hoping against hope that things could again be the way that they were. Maybe a guy hoping to salvage his own legacy. I don't know. I was not convinced. But by the time I was done talking to Lloyd Axworthy, I was no longer so sure that I'd been right about that. Wait for it. I read today that the other kids in Parliament used to call you Reverend Axworthy. What should I call you?
Well, I wouldn't use that. That's far too highfalutin. I think Lloyd's a pretty good name.
We'll go with Lloyd then. How you doing, Lloyd?
Well, thank you. Well, yourself?
I'm doing okay. I really appreciate you finding the time to chat today.
I appreciate you taking this question on. It's one of those things that's being bypassed in the present stage of Trumpism some.
How would you define the question at hand?
I think the peacekeeping itself is, I think, a very crucial part of any security toolbox and has a very good history to prove that. It has been summarily erased by senior military people in our Defense Department. We're kind of copycats of an American view that soldiers have to kill, not keep the peace. And so we went from being the most effective and substantial, important peacekeeping country in the world to being 74th on the list. We now have something like 26 people doing peacekeeping around the world.
You wrote that the high watermark here was 3,300 Canadian uniformed peacekeeping personnel in UN missions from Bosnia to Cambodia. And today, what appeared in the Globe was 29 Canadians. Maybe that's down to 26. There's a lot to unpack here, but the instigating event that led to you bringing this back up was just a little bit of a hint from the Prime Minister that maybe he's got an appetite for this again when he said that he would not exclude the presence of troops, of Canadian troops being deployed to Ukraine.
At a press conference, Mark Carney said that if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine, Canada would step up as part of the so-called coalition of the willing.
The modalities of those security guarantees on land, in the air, and the sea, and I would not exclude the presence of troops.
That's a bit of a surprising one for me to hear. We're talking about actually putting like Canadian boots on the ground in Ukraine. You're for this. You approve of this.
I think if we do it properly and effectively, we have to do an awful lot of fixing up, because so much of the apparatus and the mechanics and the procedures of peacekeeping have been abandoned. But we now have a commitment for a $9 billion increase in expenditures. I make the case that the redesign of peacekeeping should be one of the elements in that.
You're right that if we got back into it, we could demonstrate that Canada could think independently, act creatively, and help shape a new world order. And what I wondered when I read that is he describing our role in shaping a new world order, or is this a plea, kind of hope, that it's possible to reestablish the old world order? where it was really only a manifestation of like kind of Cold War, post-Cold War relationship, the protection that Canada had, the relationship with America that afforded us this role, the opportunity to step into that role. And that's done. That is just not the position we're in right now. And we have militarily, you hear a whole lot more about Arctic sovereignty or the threat of annexation from the States even. It seems almost anachronistic and strange to imagine that we're going to go off and solve the world's problems when our own future is just in such doubt right now.
There's a number of responses. I think number one, the reason why there is such a regression is because we're not getting much in the way of effective political leadership. There aren't people out there heading up the United Nations or the diplomacies or their major countries. Look what's happening when the Americans elect somebody like Donald Trump, who is about as far removed from any notion of peacekeeping as you can possibly be. You know, he's basically maniacal in his own views, and he wants to return to isolationism, but not so much isolation as imperialism. You've got the display this weekend of the new world order that's being created by China and Russia and now India coming together. They're tired of American bullying. And by the way, as Canadians, we can be sympathized because we take a lot of bullying from Trump as well. But our problem is that we have been really so intent on integrating ourselves with the U.S. economy, the U.S. culture, the U.S. military system, that we've lost a lot of our capacity for independent action. And I'm saying, I thought the last election, with the elbows up, was a real opportunity to change that. I think Canadians were getting tired of and realizing just how vulnerably, if you place so much of your eggs in the basket of one country, if they happen to elect a maniac as a president, then we are vulnerable beyond belief.
So just to get my head around what you're proposing is that you've got the countries you mentioned thumbing their nose at America and breaking off, the powerful countries that are tired of American bullying. You've got America stepping back from the international stage. And so you are imagining a new coalition of kind of the old guard of rules-based countries that were involved in the previous world order with the exclusion of America that doesn't want that job anymore, and maybe the inclusion of, I don't know, South Korea. Who do you see in this coalition?
I don't think there is just one coalition. I think that we should be moving into an international system where there's a series of networks that may not be as institutionalized as setting up a big building in New York and having 5,000 bureaucrats. I'm thinking of working together, for example, on fresh water. What's the most important commodity? Well, it's fresh water. Who are world experts on it? Canada. We have a water agency. We have programs. We should be mobilizing all those countries that are feeling the disastrous effects of climate on their water systems. And we pull that together as a network. Here's a wonderful example that the United States under Trump is rapidly dismantling all its commitments on dealing with emissions control. There's a big vacuum going up in Canada. We should be filling that vacuum. But again, we're talking about still building pipelines as opposed to developing good electrical grids.
All right. I think I got my head around kind of the Axworthy vision here, which is a series of partnerships, coalitions on different issues where we sort of reestablish those countries that are still, I guess, are kind of getting left behind as the big powers don't seem to value this stuff anymore, really strengthening the connections between us, those that still believe in it, and mounting some sort of an opposition to the cratering of the previous order.
Not just opposition, but actually offering action, getting things done. Because right now we're in a state of paralysis internationally. And the only answer we have now is to go to war to build up your military. And I'm not against making sure that we have a very good military capacity. But if it doesn't include peacekeeping, it means the only thing we're getting ready for is a war. Not security, not protection, but war.
So how does this vision of yours sit with what Carney has promised us?
I'm announcing today that Canada will achieve NATO's 2% of GDP target this year, half a decade ahead of schedule.
There's $9.6 billion in new spending to raise wages for forces members, boost recruitment, help Canada restore and maintain military equipment, and fund research into new military tech.
Because we are making a massive reinvestment in military. In fact, we're going to have an austerity budget for everything else in order to fund it. And the way that that has primarily been discussed, notwithstanding this little comment that got widely unnoticed about putting troops in the ground, possibly in Ukraine, most of what's discussed there is basically placating Trump in meeting our commitments, protecting the North, putting money in so that we get inclusion for this Golden Dome thing. None of this has to do with our responsibility to protect people around the world. The way that we're talking about military is about protecting our own damn selves. Is your vision incompatible with Carney's? And I note that you supported Freeland in the last election.
I did. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you agree, but it seems like Carney might be on borrowed time anyhow to show some results economically. Like, are these visions compatible?
I think there's no question that Carney is taking the Liberal Party and the government to a center-right position. We basically have a conservative government with a liberal name. But that's fair game, because I think it's... In a democratic society, it's useful to move back and forth. What I am concerned about, though, is that we are again buying into some of the worst mistakes that we've been made in the past. We're talking about building. If you're building something, you also have to talk a little bit about the inequity that goes along with it. That we have so many people sort of in their private jets and their major yachts who make billions of dollars. How many people are starving? How many people are going hungry? How many people in Canada young people can't buy houses because we simply buy into the notion that the market it triumphs. And so I wish the government in its two-day forum would start talking about the fact that we have serious inequities in this country, and that how do we build for them, not just for the corporations?
We're not hearing that talk at all. We did a recent episode, my colleagues who do our politics show, on youth unemployment and the devastating situation. But the canaries keep dying in the coal mine. The Canadian economy is facing some very serious trouble, and youth unemployment might just be an early warning sign. The political disenfranchisement as a result, we see the division in the streets, the rise of very angry protest movements of one stripe or another. This is back burner stuff right now, because we're supposedly fighting some kind of elbows up, very blurry, inchoate resistance to America, where the only news that we get about that is that we're actually capitulating on things like digital service taxes. These larger questions of political cohesion, political enfranchisement, and some kind of new narrative. If the point is to protect our sovereignty and independence, what the hell are we? It almost feels like the moment where we were taking those questions seriously is slipping away.
Not just slipping away, I think deliberately being erased. I mean, I think that there are those out there in very powerful positions, particularly the Silicon Valley bros and others around Trump, who really think that the best way to run the world is to have a very high-financed, wealthy oligarchy of people making decisions, and everybody else can just listen and take what's given to them. But even, and this is not just the governing Mr. Carney, you can go back to several levels of prime ministers where we've been consolidating power, increasingly, quote, in the leader. All of us become cultish, that if the leader of the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, the Democratic Party decide that we all have to buy into it. That's not my kind of liberalism. I came up as a liberal saying that it's a big tent party. There's room for business liberals and liberal liberals and regional issues. I keep getting people say, why are you ragging the government? You're a liberal. I'm doing it because I want this government to be a liberal government and not to simply become sort of a quasi-conservative government.
Do you take the threat of annexation by the United States seriously?
Yes. It won't be, I'm not sure the Marines will march, but it will be a step-by-step softening. The next big blow we're going to be facing is that Trump will wreck the Canada-US-Mexico agreement. And so those protections that particularly protect a lot of our goods and services and trades will be taken apart. I think that all of a sudden he's going to start talking about water, which he already is doing. He's going to be talking about how the same way that he suggested he can tell the president of Brazil what to do about insurrection, that he can tell somebody in Korea how they have to run their cities. This imperialism that's taking place, we are probably right on the front lines of that, and we're not very well defended. The only real sort of energy is coming from ordinary citizens who aren't buying American booze and are selling off their condos in Florida and basically saying, enough of this kind of dependency. We have to find some way, but we're not being given about how to relent. And you just made an important point, the Arctic. The protection of the Arctic is not just a military one. We established in 1997 the Arctic Council, which was designed to keep the military out of the Arctic. We had all the circumpolar countries. It was the first international institution that had indigenous people at the decision-making table. The council focused on things like climate, on social progress, on education amongst the indigenous people of the Arctic. It focused on how to protect shipping coming in, how to make sure there's proper rescue. That council should be a venue by which Canada is expressing its ability to help shape the Arctic. I hope one day soon Mr. Carney will decide to visit Greenland, because I think the American effort to subvert Greenland is taking daily efforts. As you see, the Danes are already sort of responding to these so-called influencers. Well, it's happening because Greenland is the key. It sits right on the where the straits connect the Arctic Ocean to the Atlantic. We should be out there working with the Inuit population. 80% of their population is Inuit. I'm from a province in Manitoba where close to 25% of our population is indigenous. We have an indigenous leader. We should be establishing those in that kind of network and protecting our Arctic sovereignty in those ways, not just by building up a brigade that's going to be located somewhere in Quebec or Alberta to respond to things.
That was helpful. I think if I understand you correctly, what you're suggesting is not peacekeeping as something that Canada gets re-involved in instead of protecting ourselves and protecting ourselves from American annexation, but as a means to protect ourselves, helping and protecting vulnerable places in the world and vulnerable peoples in the world in collaboration with other countries that still give a damn about that sort of thing might actually be the best defense we have against the threat of annexation. When you bring up fresh water, we may be the country in which peacekeeping is needed. I don't want to discount the advice from an elder statesman and somebody who I think we should be listening to, who can draw from a very long career and a lot of experience to tell us what might actually be worth preserving or resuscitating. But when we have a liberal government that has moved towards the right and that has just immediate needs to prove its legitimacy, that is sort of in power by accident, and if it's going to have a mandate beyond just the immediate months ahead, is going to have to pull out some real wins, or we shift to a conservative government, which is even less aligned with what you're proposing here, and there's really no third option anymore, with the NDP having lost official party status. Is this the Lloyd's point of view versus the world, or do you sense that there is any kind of a growing consensus or feeling about some of the initiatives that you're proposing here?
I think there are a lot of people in this country who are not very happy with the way we're going. But that's because most Canadians aren't given any opportunity to get engaged. There was a time that we did royal commissions. There was a time that we set up parliamentary committees across the country. When I was a foreign minister, Bill Graham was the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. I asked him to do a major study on nuclear policy for Canada. What was going to be our stance on nuclear disarmament? We don't use parliamentary committees that way anymore. I mean, it's all come from the top. It's a small group of people who surround the leader, and it becomes cultish. The thing I find disturbing, talking to many of the liberals I know, is they say, well, Carney's the right guy for the right times. And I said, good, but why isn't he sharing it? Well, why aren't we talking to Canadians? But why are we negotiating a trade deal and a security deal and not telling Canadians what we're going to do? Are we simply going to say, here's a fait accompli, now buy it? Or are we going to get people engaged? We're not using our democracy. We're not using our parliamentary system. We're not out there having to even to educate Canadians about where the world is going.
I quite agree. And you brought up earlier the will of the public. I think if we can only express our fealty to the country, our desire to be a part of this by like buying a different kind of whiskey, if that's the limit of civic engagement is I'm not going to go to Florida this year, I think there's a moment where people are willing to do a whole lot more, but I don't even know what the Prime Minister's plan is. And there's a moment where everybody was engaged, and then it just sort of slips away and we start to...
My son had an op-ed in the Globe and Mail last week talking about the need for civic education. He's a civics teacher in rural Manitoba. He was saying, kids come in and they don't... God, what was the World War II? What was the Charter of Rights? What is immigration? And he was saying, even with the military, He said, we should spend equal amount of time educating the people who are armed forces about what Canada is about and what we stand for, as opposed to how to become killers. But that kind of education is not available. That takes investment. It takes people engaged. You have to round up cooperation with educational systems, with universities, with museums. I mean, that takes some initiative. That does not mean sitting with five of your close advisors and deciding what to do.
Lloyd Axworthy, fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
That is your Canada Land for today. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. Bruce Thorsten is our senior producer, audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am Canada Land's editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So-Called Syndication, handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about Quebec's latest assaults on public displays of religion, some religions. We'll talk about the dream of an El Dorado for Canadian crude, but mostly we will talk about who's got what it takes, who is tough enough to lead the NDP.
They need to find themselves a gunslinger and a street fighter to go out there and really rally people up, get people upset about things, and attack, attack, attack.
Wait for that. Taylor C. Noakes, journalist, public historian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The NDP suffered a historic loss.
The story of the NDP collapse is really one of the stories of the night.
They got eviscerated, lost 70% of their seats.
The Liberals poached seats from the NDP in Victoria and up island. The Conservatives ate the NDP lunch.
They're down to just 7 now, which has a big impact on funding and which severely limits their ability to take part in parliamentary proceedings at all.
Leader Jagmeet Singh didn't win his own seat and announced that he would step down on election night as he conceded defeat.
I've been informed a party leader that I'll be stepping down as party leader as soon as an interim leader can be appointed.
It is because of the NDP's loss in support that the result we have last night is what it is, right? All of it migrated to mostly the Liberals, but also the Conservatives. And as a result, like, you have two parties with popular support. I believe it was, again, at last count, over 40%. I've never seen that in my lifetime.
The NDP is in no position to bring the government down. They have no leader. They've got no money. They cannot fight an election, I would say, for 3 or 4 years.
Taylor, here's what the National Observer wrote about where the NDP is at. The NDP leadership race will launch in September. Peter Julian, who headed up the 1993 renewal process the last time the NDP lost official party status, said that taking time to do it right was the key to coming back stronger. He gave the Observer an interview and he said, there is no doubt that when we have the worst result in the century, we need to properly reflect. The NDP should take 6 months to talk to party members across the country, take stock of what led to the disastrous 2025 election result, and build a stronger foundation to move forward. All right, that sounds just reasonable and sober to me. But on the other hand, it. Let's just get this race started and hope that the next guy figures it all out. Taylor, what do you make of the race for leadership of the post-official party status NDP?
The NDP is right to do some soul searching. They're certainly right to reach back out to their membership and to, you know, have the important conversation to try to figure out what went wrong. I think part of the problem is that they were being told what was going wrong for a long time prior to the collapse and did not listen or were slow to recognize what was happening to the party. It's not a surprise to me and a lot of other observers that they lost a lot of the former Labour support They had no momentum going into the election. They were never able to properly capitalize on the projects that they initiated as part of the confidence and supply agreement with the Liberals. The Liberals ended up taking most of the credit for it. But the fact is they have bounced back in the past. And if the NDP does look at their own history for inspiration as to what they might want to do forward, they need to find themselves a gunslinger and a street fighter to go out there and really rally people up, get people